This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We'll visit with one of the most remarkable people in our community, Southern University baseball coach Roger Cador. He has been the head coach at Southern for over three decades, and we will talk with him about his long tenure, son of a sharecropper. Six major leaguers have been the pupils of Roger Cador. Also on the show, Patrick Robinson. His book is Honor and Betrayal, what he calls the untold story of the Navy SEALs who captured the Butcher of Fallujah and the ordeal they later endured. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. Thanks for your support as we move along and finish the year, hopefully with a flourish, and your contributions certainly make WRKF what it is. Our guest is Roger Cador, one of the most remarkable people in the world, who's right here in our midst, 30 years as head baseball coach at Southern University. But he's much more than a baseball coach, a man who was the son of a sharecropper, born in Ventris, Louisiana in 1951, I love your parents' names, Expert and Eunice.
Isn't that amazing? My daddy truly was an expert, to be honest with you. He did so many things so good. I really looked at him as an expert.
If I ever have a son, I think I'll name him Expert.
I and, might, you know, if I have another one.
B-E-E.
Yeah.
So, Roger Cator, at Southern University, over 80 players in professional ball during your 30 years, six major leaguers. Ricky Weeks, who was a second player taken in the draft 10 years ago. And you do this without an enormous budget. Your budget compared to LSU's, for example, how is it?
Well, since 1984 when I took over, my recruiting budget was $3,000, and you know what? It never changed. I think that's, you know, when I think about it, it made me better. In that I know that I couldn't get up and the fairy tale story wasn't going to happen. It was going to take a grinding, a hard work, just being honest. And what it did, it helped me to be creative in finding ways to make things happen. I got in that office every morning and found a way. I remember years ago I read a story about a salesman in Detroit. And it was a slow day, and he was trying to, a car salesman, wanted to sell some cars, and he started going through the phone book, and he told people, hey, listen, the car you order is here. Well, those people never ordered those cars, never got it, and several people did come in knowing they didn't do it, and he was able to sell cars to them. Well, I wasn't going to go to that extreme and lie to people, but what I did is that I found ways to make calls to certain schools, high schools, and ask if they had players. And that was my way of being busy, creative, and believe it or not, I actually found some players.
$3,000 recruiting budget then and now. Roger Cator became the head coach at Southern the same year that Skip Bertman became the head baseball coach at LSU. His budget's a bit more than $3,000. But your teams have done exceptionally well. 14 SWAC championships. Roger's been named SWAC Coach of the Year 14 times, 8 NCAA appearances, and you beat the number 2 team in the country in 1987, becoming the first coach of a historically black university to win a game in the NCAA tournament. His Jaguars upset Cal State Fullerton in the South Region. Now, those are the numbers, but there's much more than numbers to what you have done as the son of a sharecropper. You came to Southern, what, in 1970?
January of 1970.
January of 1970, son of a sharecropper from Ventris, Louisiana, basketball and baseball player. I don't think you played football.
Although, no, never did.
By the way, I noticed you're listed in your professional baseball bio as 6'5", 184. So you were lean and mean in your day, and you're still lean and mean, but a little less lean.
I would say, Jim, quite less. I've lived bad over the years.
You walk every day, though, don't you?
And I walk now. I do walk every day now.
Well, he went to Rosenwald High School, right? New Roads.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you weren't too far away. But you come to Southern, 1970. Those were interesting times.
Very interesting time. Southern was all black. We weren't integrated at that time when I got there. And, a lot of unrest was taking place. You had the Vietnam War. You had a lot of people fighting for freedom. So a lot of things was taking place.
And you survived and thrived and did very well, played with some great players, both on the basketball court and the baseball diamond. Some of the biggest names in sports history of that time. Harold Carmichael, all-world receiver from the Philadelphia Eagles. He was a teammate of yours on the basketball court, right?
That's right. Isn't that amazing? And Harold was a bone leader. That's the one thing he taught was leadership, and he was so loving. That was the next thing I noticed. He was very loving and kind. So, and the thing what made Southern University so unique at that time is that everybody else was pretty much in the same boat. Not very many people had any material things. So that made it, because we walked everywhere, and we shared whatever we had. If someone from home sent a pie or something cooked, we shared it with everyone, because that's what we did at that time.
Well, Roger Cador, along with Dale Brown, they were in the 51st Annual Brotherhood Sisterhood Award winners named last month, and appropriately so for both gentlemen. And Roger gave a stirring speech about his past and about where we are as a community and as a country. I want to start with that with a column from Charles Blow, who's a Grambling graduate who writes for the New York Times. His column appeared a few days ago. It was last Saturday. He says, "It is to the people with challenges that I would like to speak today. I know your pains and your struggles. I share them. It's incredibly dispiriting when people are dismissive of the barriers we must overcome simply to make it to equal footing. I know. It's infuriating when people offer insanely naive solutions to our suffering. Stop whining and being a victim, I know. But I'd also like to share with you the way I've learned to deal with it, hoping that maybe it will offer you some encouragement. I decided long ago to achieve as an act of defiance, to define my own destiny and refuse to have it defined for me. I fully understand that trying hard doesn't always guarantee success. Success is often a fluky thing, dependent as much on luck and favor as on hard work. But while hard work may not guarantee success, not working hard almost always guarantees failure." His words were quite similar to yours a few weeks ago. What about the stigma, though, of people who are poor, without means, maybe live in crime-ridden areas, full of poverty, many in this community? Is there a way out?
It is a way out. I think Mr. Bloom said it correctly. Certainly, hard work doesn't guarantee success, but if you don't work hard, you're certainly not going to be successful. And the way out is to try and never give up and never let them see you sweat or quit. I look back at when I was growing up and all of the disadvantages I had, they existed. They existed. I wasn't very good. I couldn't read or write. I taught myself how to read and write because I wanted to. I just could not live with myself and with everyone else. And my daddy was smart. And he knew I was different. My sister often teased me and says, "Mama brought the wrong baby home." And me, and I laugh at it because I said, "How could she? When we all were born in the house, because we were delivered by midwives, and it was being black at that time, you weren't going to go to a hospital. So we were all delivered in the house." So,
how many were in your family?
Three kids. And so we were more abnormal because many other families were a lot larger because of the demand to work. Being sharecroppers, you had to have a bunch of kids to do the work. But for some reason, my parents didn't have a lot of kids. And me being the last one, really, it worked out. The day I told my daddy at 14 years old that I didn't want to do this anymore and I wanted to go to school because I wanted to make something out of myself. And he said to me, "Son, you don't know what you're talking about." And I said, yes, I do. And the beautiful thing that, as I tell a story, Jim, is that there was a wagon. Mm-hmm. He was on the east side and I was on the west side that separated us as we talked about it, just like you and I are talking in the eye-to-eye contact. And when I told him that, and my daddy knew all along it was something about me that he admired, but he never could say it to me because that's not what men did at that time, you know. And when I told him that and he looked at me and said I didn't know what I was talking about, and I told him I did, and he put his head down and he said, son, go and do what you want. Jim, those were the best words a father could say to his son. But because my father allowed me to go.
Well, we'll return in a few minutes with Roger Cater and hear more about his remarkable voyage and about what he thinks regarding where we are and where we're going. 297-5633, your number. Back after this brief pause on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and thank you so much for your support and for your support for this hour of programming. We continue with Roger Cador, the head baseball coach at Southern University in his 30th year, 14-time SWAC Coach of the Year, son of a sharecropper, born in Ventris in 1951, and he has been a fixture in this community and one of the most influential people for well over three decades. 877-217-5757, wherever you are, Inkster Show at WRKF.org, online for the remarkable Roger Cador. We were talking about your voyage to where you are and how you had to overcome obstacles that most of us have not encountered in our lives. What do you think the biggest challenge is for our community, a community you know well? You've been at Southern for 30 years as head coach, several years prior to that as an assistant coach and as a outstanding athlete, and now live in Mid-City, and now you're on the other side of town, and you know Baton Rouge about as well as anybody. What are our biggest issues right now?
Well, we have to use the resources we do have, the things that are in place. Stop making excuses about what we don't have and look at what we do have and make them work. I really feel that if we use the things we do have and make them work, we could move forward. We spend way too much time complaining, and I think that's one of the things. I look at my situation at Southern. We literally had nothing. But what I saw my kids on was the opportunities that we did have, and let's work hard to do it. I remember my first 10 years, I had nowhere to practice. We didn't have a practice field. And rather than make an excuse about it, that was some of my most productive years. I had gotten my players to be extremely productive because not one day did I allow them to come and say, we don't have this, coach. And I did got them to look at what we did have was an opportunity to prove, not just to people, but to themselves, that you could take very little and make a lot out of.
Well, Roger Cater has been tapped by Major League Baseball to examine diversity issues in major leagues and in professional baseball. I didn't realize it. You're a friend of Bud Selig, aren't you? How did that happen?
You know, it's amazing that I got on that committee. When you look at it, I'm extremely fortunate. You have presidents, owners, and general managers who are on that committee, and then they have one college coach, and it's Roger Cador. Jim, how could that ever happen? I can't really talk too much about what we are doing because next month we meet maybe for the last time in Phoenix, and then we're hopeful we can come up with a solution to address it. But Bud Selig wants to be the one that gets out in front and make the announcement exactly what we are doing.
Why do you think fewer African-Americans are playing baseball? They play other sports, and of course some of the greatest players in the history of the game have been black, perhaps the greatest in Barry Lamar Bonds.
Barry Lamar!
That's right. A guy much maligned for steroid use, but when you look at the numbers, he had more home runs in a career, more home runs in a single season, and just had a phenomenal career with the Pirates and the Giants. But maybe that's part of the problem. He never was loved by the fans. Why do black athletes tend to choose football and basketball over baseball?
You know, that's a puzzling story. I could give you my opinion. There's been more of a emphasis. Normally, kids go where emphasis and attention to focus. And years ago, baseball was the sport. Now, it's not that more. I know a lot of people blame Michael Jordan for screwing up a lot of black kids to go into basketball because they wanted to be like him. But football is a sport in America. It's the number one sport in America, and it's violence. And there's a certain segment in society who like what happens on the football field.
They like the violence.
They like it. They like it. And I can't understand it. I don't tell parents not to let their kids play football, but I look at all of the type of training that goes into making a football player. You have to teach aggression, aggressiveness. And so when you teach it, there are a lot of other stuff you're teaching to go along with this aggressiveness. And then when kids not playing football, it's hard for them to get back to being a regular person. You know what I'm saying? So you tend to see more football players getting in trouble with aggressiveness, act. And I think it's the teaching that exists. But, you know, it is a great sport. It's number one in America. And families are going to do it because mm-hmm. they say, oh, my kid can make money. But you got to look at down the road, the injuries and all the other stuff that comes with it. Baseball is such a wonderful sport because you're from the shoulder on up. A lot of the stuff you do, you make great decisions. I think it's a great sport that parents ought to consider keeping their kids in.
297-5633 for Roger Kador, head baseball coach at Southern University. What about the crime rate in Baton Rouge? The murder rate among the highest in America? Why?
I think education does play a huge role. People may not understand that. If you don't have education, education helps solve some problem. It allows you to solve some of the problems. It helps you to make good decisions. Your decision making becomes a lot better. And I think lack of education and the fact that we haven't done enough in making sure that the less fortunate people are of giving more attention to. Maybe just a little more love. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, this is one of the things. When people get to a certain level, you tend to overlook them and throw them to the side. The thing that we need to understand is they're never going to go away. The nuisance never going to go away. That's why we've got to try and find ways to reach out to those people and let them know they're important. They have a value. And once people see people care about them and they have value, they make better decisions.
877-217-5757, wherever you are. And that's a number that Mr. James Verrett is calling from. I know a name you know and I know, fine journalist in his right. Calling from South Carolina, I believe. Good morning, James.
No, Greensboro, North Carolina. Okay. How you doing, Coach Kador?
Hey, James. You know, James was one of my former players, by the way.
I did know that. And looks like he could still play.
He could really run back then.
Yeah.
Yeah, Coach, I'd like to congratulate you on all your years of service. And I like to tell everybody, you were the main person who steered me toward journalism as a profession. Because I was playing, and I had an opportunity to work at Channel 9, and I didn't want to leave the team. And you said, son, the job is to get a job. So you need to go and pursue that, rather than trying to hit a curveball, because I wasn't very good at hitting curveballs at that time.
Well, I'm so happy, James, that you did, and you've been a shining light. I watch you when you do your work with the NBA over there in Atlanta. So you're still there?
No, I actually moved to Greensboro, North Carolina. My wife is the associate athletic director at A&T, and I'm doing work with a new network called Bounce TV.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, I'm happy to hear that, you know, this is another one of those young men, James, that have come through the program. And we always encourage our people to reach mm-hmm. out and strive to be the very best. And, James, you made me very proud.
Well, Coach, I thank you so very much for everything. And, Jim, I thank you for your show because I'm listening to it on my app on my iPad, and I do that every morning before I head out to work.
Well, thank you, James, wow. and congratulations. That's quite an honor to hear that from you. And I saw James a few months ago at the Rotary Club at Boudreaux's, where he was honored for his journalistic talents. And you gave a very candid speech. I remember one of the things you said, if you want to be in TV, don't get fat.
Correct. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Porkiness is not very good on television these days.
Well, James, thanks for calling, and thanks for your nice words about Coach Cater and yours truly.
James, good to hear you.
And one thing before I go, if you want to get more African-Americans involved in baseball, I think the community needs to do a better job of promoting the sport. You know, basketball and football go out of their way to go into the community to promote, and I love what Coach is doing with Major League Baseball, but I think it's a community effort, not only from churches, but even schools. Start while they're young in T-ball and work their way up. That's what I did.
That's what we're going to do.
Thank you, James.
All right, James.
All right.
From Greensboro, North Carolina. Now, a few days ago, as in yesterday, front page of the Baton Rouge Advocate, Clayton, as in your friend and mine, Tony Clayton,
yes,
wants Grambling replaced in the Bayou Classic. You're smiling. Tony doesn't shy from controversy, does he?
You know, one of the things is that's why I admire Tony, because he doesn't wear his emotion on his sleeve. He puts himself out there. Some of his stuff makes sense. I mean, it's about making money, and he's looking at the bottom line here. So I think he's rattling some cages or somebody's feather. We'll see what happens.
What did you think of the Grambling boycott? Those players are dealing with the kinds of things you're talking about, the resources that have been depleted. They obviously were upset about a coaching change as well, but interestingly, Dave Anderson, one of the most respected sports writers in America with the New York Times, has been around for a half century. When he listed the things that he was most thankful for on Thanksgiving a week ago, he listed that number two. He thought they did something heroic by not showing up for the bus trip to Jackson, Mississippi.
Well, I think it shows the lack of leadership up there with the president. What's so sad is that Doug had raised the money to do it, and he wouldn't let Doug use the money. I think Doug Williams, yeah. I just think that when people in leadership situation start putting themselves above the situation, see, he didn't understand that this could happen, and he showed how powerless he really is. And this is a great example for all these people who consider themselves to have power. You start screwing around with young kids today, they're going to show you a thing or two when you don't do them right. That's what I admired about it. So, this power thing, you need to throw it out the window and do what's right. If we could find people who think about the long term, make sure you do what's best for the kids for the long haul, this kind of stuff would never have happened.
I got chided a few days ago, and I think appropriately so, by Leonard Joseph, who listens to this show. This was 2 days ago. He says, today is World AIDS Day, and you're not talking about it. Now, we've talked about Baton Rouge leading the nation in AIDS, unfortunately, on this program, and it would have been an appropriate topic Monday. But after a while, I don't know what more can be said, but it's an issue that politicians just don't want to deal with. The governor certainly doesn't talk about Baton Rouge being number one, New Orleans being number three. How significant is this?
It's very significant. I think we've got to find a way to – that's something that mankind can do something about. I think we can – education becomes paramount of importance again if we educate people. And then lend a hand to people who have it, try to solve it. because for what people, Jim, sort of thinking that they're immune from this happening to them, and when you start thinking, this could happen to me, you know what I'm saying? You really could happen to you. And so you need to, don't say, you got this, your problem, it's not my problem. If it's a problem in Baton Rouge, it's everyone's problem. And people better wake up to the fact that if there's a problem here, we're all going to suffer from it. Mm-hmm. One way or the other, we can't get out of our house if it's not safe. So don't think you can move somewhere and say, those people in North Baton Rouge, we're going to isolate them, can't do it.
How many players have you had over the last 30 years, approximately, at Southern, on the diamond, for Roger Cador?
I don't know. I've had a lot. When you say the total number of kids I've coached?
Yeah. At least 500, I think.
Oh, no, more than that. Let's say 2,000.
2,000, because you don't turn anybody away.
I don't turn anybody away.
You got the biggest roster in the history of baseball. Yeah.
When I first started, I was coaching 100 kids by myself.
Let's do this again soon. Roger Cator, congratulations on what you've done and what you will continue to do, and thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Jim.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Thank you for your support. And our guest is Patrick Robinson. His book is Honor and Betrayal, the untold story of the Navy SEALs who captured the Butcher of Fallujah and the shameful ordeal they later endured. Patrick Robinson is a celebrated journalist. He has written a few New York Times bestsellers, including Lone Survivor, and he is a man who knows warfare and writes about it as well as anybody in our world today. Good morning, Patrick Robinson.
Morning, Jim. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. Sounds like you might be on a speakerphone, though. Is that?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm just in a room without a lot of furniture.
Okay. Well, we'll go with what we have. I can hear you, and I think our listeners can, too. JC is shaking her head. Yes. Well, on a daring nighttime raid in September of 2009, a team of Navy SEALs grabbed the notorious terrorist, a man who you have been following for many years, called the Butcher of Fallujah. And what happens?
Well, he was we better remind our listeners, perhaps, that he was the guy who strung up four Americans who he burned alive on the bridge over the Euphrates in Fallujah in 2004, which was just about the most fiendish action by a terrorist ever. I've never met one quite as bad. The Americans chased him for 5 years without catching him. Every time they got close, he kind of vanished. I mean, he was a real terrorist. He was, you know, he was like a mafia don who scared Fallujah to death. And the SEALs, Echo Platoon, Team 10, based just outside of Baghdad, were, in fact, ordered to take him, capture, or kill him 5 years after that. That would have been in 2009. And they, 20 of them, set out over the desert to do so. They had to be dropped 3 miles from this Al-Qaeda stronghold where he was, because the helicopter would have obviously alerted everyone that they were on the way. And they had to walk in, and they walked across this pitch-dark, lethal desert, going for a terrorist stronghold, which is about as dangerous a mission as you can have. But they got there, and they cut their way through the wire, got into the complex, smashed their way into the a kind of a barracks or apartments, and they secured it, and Matt got through to the, Matt McCabe, the team leader, got through to the back end of the place and smashed the door open to a bedroom, and there was the Butcher of Fallujah lying on his mattress with his gun right next to his hand. So anyway, Matt captured him, grabbed him, cuffed him, got him up, and then threw him down again, and ultimately they ransacked the place for terrorist stuff, passports, money, and all the rest of it. And Frog marched him back to the helicopter and got him into captivity. It was hugely dangerous, but anyway, that's what they did, and it was picture-perfect SEAL operation.
All right, and let's get into this. Honor and Betrayal is the story about this amazing effort by these Navy SEALs. And first of all, this guy, the Butcher of Fallujah, you say he mutilated four American contractors, burned them alive?
Yeah, he caught them in their car and had them surrounded by machine guns, and they knew if they got out, they would be mown down. He just shot them in the car, and then he set fire to the car, and then he had the car caught fire, and they dragged their mutilated, burned bodies out and strung two of them on the back of the car and towed them through Fallujah and then hauled them up on ropes for the television cameras on the Euphrates Bridge, where they were kind of swinging in the wind and watched by the whole world by this time. You know, made the front page of the New York Times and everywhere else. A diabolical thing to have done. And the U.S. military's pursuit of this guy was absolutely relentless. And this particular September night in 2009, they had real information about where he was. And they sent the guys in to get him, and they did.
All right, Matthew McCabe, Jonathan Keefe, and Sam Gonzalez. What happened?
That's right.
What happens? They
went in with there were 20 in the team, and they were sort of three of the principal SEALs.
And what happened to them?
Well, when they got him back, they got a terrorist bang, put him in the slammer, and 2 hours later, he had a little cold sore on his lip, which mysteriously he cut. He bit it. And got some blood down his shirt, and immediately said, like all terrorists who are captured by Americans, he immediately said he'd been abused, beaten up, kicked, battered, wanted a lawyer, his human rights, and God knows what else. And a section of the Navy believed him, which was about the craziest thing that ever happened. And to make a long story short, the SEALs all faced court-martial, three of them. Jonathan, who was the point man out in front of the team coming in over the desert on his own, Matt, who was the team leader, and Sam, who was the senior non-commissioned officer in charge of the communications. And these three were court-martialed. For Matt, for banging the prisoner in the mouth, which he hadn't. The others for obscuring the truth, conspiracy to hide up a crime, everything you can think of, you know. Conspiracy to hide it all, lying. I mean, they threw the book at all three of them.
Why do you believe them and others did not?
Why do I believe them? Well, everybody believed them except for the prosecution. Three judges and three jurors, they threw all three cases out. The military were given a dozen opportunities not to proceed because it was insane, and they were obviously going to be found not guilty, which indeed they were. But the spin-off from this was very bad. Jonathan and Matt both left the Navy SEALs, and they were both destined for command level. Four of the lawyers who defended them left. Three or four of the team who went in addition to them, resigned from the Navy. These are smart people. Two of them went to law school.
Well, Patrick, how can young men like this, who served our country heroically and bravely, take out the Butcher of Fallujah, how in the world can they end up being castigated by their own country?
It's a damn good question, Jim. You know, the military pass things up the chain. You know, it starts off with a kind of a corporal or a seaman, and then it gets pushed up to a chief. Then it will get to a chief petty officer, and it will be looked at by a lieutenant commander, then a captain, then an admiral. They always push it up. Civilian life, they are not so keen to do that, but that's what they do in the military. And it just gets being pushed up. And this one had, in my view, definite political ramifications. This was a punch that may or may not have been thrown. Nothing else. That's what it was. And it got as far as General Petraeus, who's the head of the United States Army at the time. Now, that is absolutely staggering. That's the kind of thing that happens when there's been a massacre, and not a punch that may or may not have been thrown, and plainly wasn't thrown. Because as Jonathan Keefe said, I thought memorably, if Matt had hit him in the mouth, he'd still be in intensive care. Hmm. I mean, he hadn't. Seals don't hit people in the mouth. I mean, it's just kind of crazy. And everyone knew it, except that chain of command. And in my view, and the view of at least four of the lawyers, and probably all of them, there was a political hand in this. I mean, this was too big a deal for any of these high-ranking military people. There was a political hand saying to Middle Eastern rulers, if our boys step out of line, they will be punished. President Obama has said that on more than one occasion, and there were Middle Eastern talks coming up, and it is the opinion of the legal profession that in this particular case, they were being told, don't let the president go in unarmed, being told that, you know, these three guys were let off when they had plainly beaten up a Middle Eastern person.
Well, the book is Honor and Betrayal, the untold story of the Navy SEALs who captured the Butcher of Fallujah and the shameful ordeal they later endured. A riveting book by our guest, Patrick Robinson. Thank you for joining us, Patrick.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.